How is Andrews feeling today after his big birthday bash?
I'm here. I'm alive. Anders Lee here, as they say, as I say about myself every day. And good admixture of substances.
How many substances did you do for your birthday?
4 or 5.
Okay, not bad.
It was a good equilibrium. I wasn't like too high on any one, thankfully.
But Anders Lee stayed here the whole time. You didn't lose yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I was in a better mood than usual for part of it, so that felt like I had drifted away. But yeah, it was a good. We're talking today I'm in my Jesus year now. The second day.
You're in your Jesus year. Congrats, man. You made it.
Thank you. 3 years into 33, or 3 days into 33. I'd like to
threaten to overthrow an empire or something?
I chewed a bunch of cot. That was my main.
Yeah, where did you get cot?
Bodega.
Are they chewing it at the bodega?
Yes. I've
been offered it at the bodega before.
Really?
This city is just Yemeni bodegas left and right, man.
Yeah. Yeah, the one on our block. I did have a guy who was going to hook me up with it, but he fell through. Did not come through.
Yeah, I didn't trust that guy. But what was the effect of cot? Like, how did it make you feel?
It's a stimulant. It's kind of an upper. But I do think you have to chew a lot of it, because I went back to the bodega actually last night to get lighter fluid.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I had taken this for granted before, but both their brothers who hang out at who live and work at the bodega, I don't know if they live there, they both had just giant wads in their cheeks.
Right.
And I realized, like, oh, they're like that. They're always doing this. And the wad was like maybe half the bag that they
gave. Yeah, because you just gave me like a little pinch. Yeah. And I tried to take a bigger pinch, and you were like, oh, you want more? Okay. And just the second one didn't do much for me.
Yeah, you do need a lot, apparently.
You're becoming sort of like an oral fixation guy, Andy, between the sins and the cot. And I can let you try Skol if you'd like. You might enjoy it.
No.
I do it all day at work. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get addicted to as many low-level drugs as possible.
Yeah, if you just have a mild addiction to a bunch, then it's not that's right. Serious. You just have to make sure you have all of them.
What do you have nailed down? You got kratom, you got caffeine, you got nicotine, you got cot. What else even is there that's low stakes? DMT?
THC.
Oh, THC.
Yeah, he's addicted to DMT. That'd be fun.
Low stakes DMT.
Yeah. I mean, some people, what do you guys think about drugs? And I mean, the whole specter of performance enhancing drugs is a big topic with, you know, speaking.
What do I think about it?
I could probably use some performing enhancing drugs for my speech right now, because I'm still.
You want a Velo?
But what is that?
It's like a Zin.
And what does it do? It's just like tobacco?
Yeah, you get like a nicotine rush.
Okay.
You might. Actually, let me give you a smaller dose.
I might need now, some water.
Anders, if you're talking about performance-enhancing drugs, and I think we're going to talk about sports a little bit today,
yes.
I'll have you know that I come from a place where just about everybody I work with has an enlarged heart and shrunken testes. So I can, like, attest to the effects of said performance-enhancing drugs.
Mm.
Steroids, of course, being rife in my line of work. Not me, though. I would never fuck with steroids.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. I was about to say you work at a place where they take your semen and put it into your heart.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a side thing. That's just to get on the job, man.
That sounds like something Jordan Peterson would believe is happening in China.
Right? Yeah. It's like semen extraction or whatever the fuck.
All right. So we are here for episode 3 of And.
Yes.
And we have our first non-and on the program. We got Sean KB.
Hey, first time, long time.
Maybe
happy
we should.
We're renaming him Shand KB. Or
Shand.
Shand or Shandy?
Shandy. Or that's a good one.
Shandy. Shanders. These are all nice names.
Shandor?
Shandor, sure.
There's a lot of good names.
We can get Shandor on the show.
Shandor John?
Yeah.
Who's this?
He was my old teacher at the City University of New York.
He'd be a good guest.
One of, He's one of the most rabid Trotskyists I ever met.
Oh, yeah, actually, really, he probably doesn't like me anymore for what I wrote about Trotskyism. I have not heard, he helped me out with the book, but I have not heard of him since it came out.
I mean, he's probably been in mourning since the ISO went down like 5 or 6 years
ago. No. He is quite the opposite of in mourning about that.
Oh, is he a Spartacist?
He is part of a split from the Spartacists called the Internationalists.
The IG.
They are actually, I would say, a stronger organization now than the Sparts.
I've seen them at protests. This is the professor guy who is kind of taller. I've seen him around.
He's not very tall.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that.
They have a lot of young people.
I took a class on Latin America and imperialism from him, which is, you know, important stuff to know. And I had read like plenty of Lenin and Marx, even though I was just like a young kid. It was like 2006 or something like that. And I used to make jokes all the time with like Marxist theory and Leninism and like make fun of Trotsky in my papers and shit. And he pulled me aside once. He's like, why don't you take this shit seriously? And I was like, bro, I don't know. It's 2006 or seven. There's no crisis. There's no problems with capitalism. Like, what the fuck? Why would I take this shit seriously? It's the end of history. And then next thing you know, womp womp.
Yeah, that was essentially his issue with my book, too, is it's like you're playing too lightly with real revolutionaries who fought and died. And I think my book does a good job of taking them seriously, but
I don't think you were patronizing or condescending at all.
But it's framed around like silly memes, and I think that's what he doesn't like. But anyway,
well, that's just what the kids need to make them interested in his politics.
Let's talk about another rabid leftist professor from Berkeley, California, in the late 60s. Today we're talking about Jack Scott. I imagine our listeners have not heard of this guy. He is really a figure somewhat forgotten to history, but a very interesting one, especially really a pioneer in American sports radicalism.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called The Athletic Revolution in 1970 that is almost impossible to find. We found it on a site called Anna's Archives.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Anna. I don't know who you are, but like, you have
$300 on Amazon.
Is it that right-wing Hegelian on Twitter or no? I hope not.
Can I spit this out,
by the way, before we dive in? I am feeling it. And
yeah, take it out. Take it out.
How do I do it? How do I get it?
You can put it back in if you want.
You have a trash?
Just,
I don't want to trash Andy's room.
Yeah, just put it on there.
Thank you. Oh man, that's intense taste wise.
He'll finish it for him. Chew his gum after he's finished with it too.
Andy, I could see you maybe doing that. I mean, Andy and I a few months ago were walking through Williamsburg, and it's like late at night. And he's like, "I'll be right back," and he comes back just with a slice of pizza in his hand, which he claims is fully intact.
Yeah, no, it was fine. Old habits die hard. So
I'm Apache, always I'm Apache.
So Jack Scott, Berkeley professor of sports and sociology.
Oh my god!
And he was one of the first people, along with a couple other writers from the Black radical tradition, who saw the significance of Black radicalism in the athletic sphere in the late '60s, beginning largely with Muhammad Ali joining the Nation of Islam and taking a strong stance against being drafted and against white supremacy in sports in general, with the runners in the 68 Olympics who gave the Black Power salute, and also a lot of things that followed around that, like in baseball, which I'm writing about. There was the unionization of the baseball players in 66, which a huge, largely untold part of that story is that the players really got organized enough to fully strike and withhold their labor as a result of Black players demanding that they not play games after the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Similar to 2020.
Yes, absolutely. And so before this period, sports had been seen as apolitical, as a refuge from politics. Black athletes were expected to, you know, be chill and not complain and just, you know, enjoy their segregated and subservient position within the sports hierarchy and be grateful for it. college athletes tended to be very reactionary. In 1968, when there was the occupation at Columbia, the football team was sort of on the front lines of breaking or preventing occupations. And so between 68 and 1970, Jack Scott notices that younger people, especially young black athletes, are coming into college sports, and they want to be a part of the movement. And so a major part of his book, The Athletic Revolution, was that in 1970, you saw in Columbia a faction of black athletes wanting to join the new student strike there against the invasion of Cambodia.
Man, this stuff is hitting hard.
You all right, Anders?
This is stronger than anything I had last year.
That's why the COD had no effect on me.
He's off that shit.
Oh, I'm like sweating.
That quote that I was looking for is he cites a Nixon official who said that once we have the football players and the cheerleaders protesting against us, we know we have a problem. So this is where he begins what was called at the time the Jock Liberation Army, where he was trying to organize athletes around the country, not only to take part in the movement against the war, the movement for a democratic society, but also to revolutionize the way sports are played in the country. There's a lot of stuff to talk about in the athletic revolution, but one detail I'll mention from it before we go more into the trajectory of Jack Scott's life was that he has got a section on amateur sports, and he cites this scholar of Greek sports. "So long as sport is true to itself, the only purpose of the organization of it is the enjoyment of the players. As soon as the interests of the spectators are allowed to become predominant, corruption has set in and the essence of the game has been lost." So he envisions a new kind of sports where the pleasure and the enjoyment of playing is centered. Spectatorship is okay, but he wants to see a democratic new model for sports in which the players are in control. Coaches are, they still exist, but they don't have this sort of top-down military kind of discipline to it. In general, it's no longer about competition to like prove you're the best school or the best city or to make massive profits for whoever, the owners of the team or for the university, but sports itself becomes center.
My dissertation that I finally ended up writing coming out of 1968 Cornell University was titled Sociology of Sport, and it became the first integrated textbook focusing on a sociological analysis of sport as a social institution. Up until that time, sport had been relegated to physical education. Sociologists didn't feel that it was up to their standard as an area of career focus or analysis. And one of the big challenges that I had was convincing even the people at Cornell that sport was worth looking at, that despite 105 years of sociology, a major institution, an increasingly important institution, had been overlooked and bypassed, mostly out of academic arrogance, that this was beneath us to deal with these physical activities. How can we believe as sociologists that a dyad, a two-person relationship, or a triad, a three-person relationship, is worthy of analysis that includes volumes and hundreds of dissertations, but 100 million people watching the Super Bowl is not worthy of investigation from a sociological perspective?
So this is sort of the premise of where he starts with his organization in Berkeley that had a number of athletes and writers involved in it, and he becomes this central figure in the radicalization of sports moving into the 70s.
I want to say real quick, like 50-something years out, was it 54 years out, that God, has it gone the other fucking direction. And the, you know, sport that I follow the most is baseball. And when I used to go to baseball in the 80s and the 90s, you know, there was like some peace and quiet between innings. You know, everybody brought their sheet and they marked out all the plays and stuff. And you had intelligent discussion back and forth about the game and the pitcher and like the stats that people were coming up with on the back of a napkin. And now if you go to a baseball game, you know, that not only does the spectator dominate, the consumer of sports dominate, but also there's like loud noises and like forced cheers and like sounds and songs like at every fucking moment, like you're at a club or something like that. Like people
especially
can't just,
at Citi Field. Yeah, they actually have DJs during the game. And recently the umpire had to ask the DJs to turn down the music because the players could hear it and it was annoying.
I was recalling.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like it, now it's like a spectacle. It's become like the spectator is now at the center of things, but the spectator isn't meant to like interface through the play cards and stuff like that and speak with one another about what's going on. Instead, they're meant to sit there and be like passively buffeted by sounds at every moment to make sure they don't think about anything or talk about anything. They consume their like $80 to $200 ticket at in the bleachers, you know.
I was recalling the Ally McBeal ad. Remember that big controversy? I was thinking about this recently, and a lot of I think it's been kind of forgotten, but that was a huge scandal in like the early 2000s. They superimposed an Ally McBeal ad that was not actually there IRL onto like a wall at a baseball game for television, and everyone was outraged at how like how tacky that was for the network to do that. And now it's like that's you see that every single game you watch. They're just like, you know,
was it the dancing baby from Ally McBeal?
that's what I said too.
I think it was just her face and like, you know, Sundays at 9 or whenever it was, just on the they just like had it on a wall, and people were mad about it. But yeah, now it's just that's quaint.
Mm-hmm. Getting back into a little bit of the life of Jack Scott. So Robert Lipsight of the New York Times wrote about Jack Scott in 1970.
Kind of roasted him.
And he describes him striding into a jam-packed auditorium of 400 students, dressed like a coach and blowing a whistle to start class. And his study of sports and society organization included a Newsday sports reporter, St. Louis Cardinals linebacker, Dave Mseggi, and they published a book together about the NFL called Out of Their League, and then Harry Edwards, who was a sports sociologist, who wrote a book in 1969 called The Revolt of the Black Athletes. So he had this circle of sports radicals around him, and they were organizing the athletes at Berkeley to be part of the movement. But of course, The movement falls apart around 1970 because of this reaction we were talking about, you know, the hard hat riot and the movie Joe that we did an episode about. There was this, you know, the silent majority rises up against the movement and kind of kills it. So that sort of sends Jack Scott into a bit of an exile in an extent. But before that, he gets hired at Oberlin. Mm-hmm. To run the athletics department at Oberlin.
Yeah.
Wow, they put a commie in charge.
Yeah. It's interesting because in that New York Times piece, they're kind of lamenting why the 70s doesn't have that same kind of zeal surrounding sports and like what happened to this movement. And they're kind of saying that that sports is kind of inherently reactionary in the 70s. They seem to be kind of suggesting that. And it's funny, again, today you have now this contingent of people on the right who are like, sports is woke. And it's like, it's a small amount of people, but you see them on Twitter sometimes, and they're like, there's so many other important things going on in the world, and this is keeping you docile, paying attention to athletics.
Well, it goes back to like Noam Chomsky, and I used to parrot this line, I think, in high school and be really fucking annoying about it. But like, and I don't know when he wrote this, Chomsky, in some essay about sports and nationalism in like the 80s or the 90s. But he's like, oh, sports and sports teams based in different cities or college teams, it's training people towards like irrational nationalism, right? Because you're like a hometown fan and you hate Red Sox fans, and Red Sox fans hate you. And so it's like a way, he argues, of like turning people into haters, essentially. And so then the same principle, of course, going into nationalism. I don't really believe that anymore, but I think that's kind of what you're alluding to, right? That sort of critique.
Well, yeah, but now conservatives have picked it up, and they've said that this is just a bunch of pablum and
bread and circuses.
Yeah,
yeah,
but it's coming from right. But it's funny, the Chomsky streak, I don't buy either, especially because like America is like one of the most, you know, nationalistic countries in many ways. But I would say our rivalries pale in comparison to the rest of the world, where you have people just like beating each other up. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that happens here, that's obviously, true. But like
not compared to like Poland.
Yeah.
No. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. Like in Europe, like soccer hooliganism is really the sort of deeply localist, you know, sort of violent matches that are the soccer sort of fades away in comparison to the importance of different, you know, local young youth like going to war with each other about for the pride of their town, essentially, with sometimes with political overtones,
right?
But largely,
wasn't there like an actual war in South America between two nations over soccer at one point?
Am I making that up? Colombia, I believe.
All right,
okay. It was actually caused by that.
It was, I mean, it was sort of like the thing that set it off. It was like a territorial dispute, and then the soccer game. Some dispute during this. I don't remember the details, but yeah.
Did they settle it on the field? They're like, we're going to, I mean, because that's a good idea.
I think the game resulted in a riot that like,
that led to a war.
But here's a different vision of sports in like 1970. At rallies he's organized and participated in at Berkeley, Scott had witnessed firsthand how athletic intensity could be channeled into radical zeal. In the lead up to the 1970 Cal Stanford game, his friend Sam Goldberg, a top decathlete and Olympic hopeful from Kansas, told a crowd, "You will see athletes melt down their medals and trophies to make bullets for the revolution."
Oh, God.
"And any athlete who is serious about liberation and revolution must be prepared to kill his coach."
Wow.
At the big game itself, Goldberg wrapped himself in a Viet Cong flag and stormed the field at halftime, only to receive a drubbing from the Stanford marching band. So
sure. They were the trombone was like burr, 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 burr.
Yeah. So not exactly the Kaepernick of his time, but there were these seeds of athletes who were part of the movement, including Bill Walton, who we'll get to. He plays a part in this story. Are you familiar with Bill Walton, Sean?
No, I never. I've heard of the Walton family, but I don't think there's any relation.
No.
Well, Bill Walton, rest in peace, recently passed away, but he's a part of the story. But before we get there, Scott becomes this new left celebrity from the Athletic Revolution book. When Kent State happens, the Hard Hat Riot and all that stuff we talked about, the movement fractures, becoming, you know, these small sects of academics, entryist workerists or armed struggle sects. And Scott would eventually sort of team up with the SLA in a journalistic capacity. But before that, he's hired at Oberlin in 1972 on the strength of his new left celebrity. Once he gets the job there, he installs these reforms. And this is quoting from the Californian article. I think it's a publication from UCal. "They would barely raise eyebrows today, but at the time they were considered remarkable. They included doing away with the entrance fees to athletic events, placing greater emphasis on women's sports, hiring a number of black head coaches at the predominantly white school. Among those he brought in by Scott was sprinter Tommy Smith of the black-gloved Olympic protest movement in Mexico City." Those are the people that did the Black Power salute. Mm. His coaches even recruited a couple of ringers for the football team, including a Hispanic quarterback who helped lead Oberlin to its first winning season in years. So at first, everything is all good in Oberlin under Jack Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Was Jack Scott a Maoist? Like, he's proposing a sort of cultural revolution in sports.
You know, from what I can tell in the Athletic Revolution, he's just sort of a straight up new leftist.
Yeah.
Like, just like pure, unadulterated new left ideology.
So Mao is in there. SDS stuff is in there. But I don't think he was affiliated with a singular party.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably for the best.
I think one of his faults is like he is like a hippie. You know, he wants the athletes, like, everybody chill out, be autonomous, be free. But instituting that, he's very, like, authoritarian in a way about how hardcore he is about forcing the athletes to be free. in a sense.
Right, right.
So he had a 4-year contract at Oberlin, but a little after a year after he was hired, more than 200 athletes signed a list of complaints that was published in the school paper, claiming that Scott was overly dictatorial for implementing his democratic measures. he would threaten anyone who opposed him. Here's a quote from that Californian article. Dan Millman, a former Cal gymnast and world trampoline champion who Scott recruited as a coach at Oberlin, would later tell the FBI that Jack was brutal in his treatment of older establishment types and would often become so angry that he would clench his fists and tremble with rage. In one case, he allegedly assaulted a teenager. Even Fuller, who championed his hiring, admitted to agents that Scott was difficult, possibly even dangerous. He and Millman both mentioned concerns that the AD might bomb the gym on his way out the door.
Jesus Christ. He's going weather underground, bro.
Yeah.
And that was no idle threat because Jack Scott was connected to a attempted bombing in Oakland. You know, he wasn't charged in it, but a friend of his was. And so he was very into the armed struggle aspect of it as well, which we'll get into.
He definitely had some anger problems.
Yeah.
So things are already going off the rails by like 1970 for this dude.
So 1972 gets hired, and then he's fired 2 years later.
So as the new left is like going into its kind of like declining psycho phase,
yep.
Jack Scott's whole mission is also turning a little unripe.
Yeah. And this is, I guess, kind of a new left thing. He's like, he's invoking the Constitution. He's saying like, I want the same thing.
Right.
Founding fathers want American democracy. And sports should be democratic in this kind of liberal sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is where the SDS and the New Left comes out of. It's like this differing conception of democracy that is more based in communities, based on smaller scale, you know, giving people control over their own lives. But still, you know, at first, like with the Port Huron statement, it is not, they're working with the UAW and are largely connected with the goals of the sort of center-left labor movement. But of course, through the 60s, seeing the rise and decline of the civil rights movement, the emergence of black power, and of course, the increasingly fervent opposition to the war in Vietnam, that position becomes much more internationalist, much more hostile to America. And that image inspires this really brutal backlash that really fractures the movement in the early 70s. Then, of course, you get the SDS splitting up into a Maoist faction and then into the armed struggle faction of the Weathermen.
Right.
So catching up with Jack Scott when he gets fired from Oberlin, he moves to New York to write a book about PEDs, COT and Zin and all that stuff.
Performance-enhancing drugs.
But which would have been a great book because obviously that became a huge issue in the 90s and 2000s with the steroid scandal in baseball. But at the time, it wasn't really being talked about, and players had been using amphetamines and other substances
for LSD.
Some of them have been using LSD. I don't. Maybe performance enhancing for some.
Beer and cigars.
What year was the Doc Ellis no hitter?
It was in the early 70s. I'm not sure exactly when, but yeah, I was in my research on baseball because you know cocaine becomes the first major sort of drug issue for baseball in the mid-80s, a scandal involving the mascot for the Pittsburgh Pirates and who was dealing cocaine to Pirates players and visiting players, including Keith Hernandez, who got wrapped
probably
up in the scandal.
Daryl Strawberry probably too. I'm just guessing. I don't know.
I think he actually got into cocaine a little bit later. Doc Gooden got into it first, and he got into it from his friends in Tampa.
Okay, this is where we have you as an expert source here because I'm just presuming that Daryl got into it.
He could have, but this was a little bit before. You know, Daryl was still like a teenager at the time, so might have been a little bit more clean cut when he first entered baseball. But Keith Hernandez was doing cocaine. Anyway, we're getting a little off subject here. So he wants to go write this book about PEDs, but you know he's from the Athletic Revolution. It's like a good book, but it's not. You can tell he's not the best writer. He's more of a professor,
he's
a
doer.
Public speaker. Yeah,
yeah.
So he was having trouble writing this book, and around this time, the SLA is becoming a major national story. So I'll give a background on the SLA now. In the late 60s, there's a prisoner outreach program in Berkeley. A faction of this prisoner outreach group gets really into Guevara and Regis Debray and the concept of the urban guerrilla. And they're in contact with one prisoner named Donald DeFries, who I think he was in prison for assault or something like that, you know, a violent crime of some sort. In 1973, he escapes from Soledad State Prison, and he links up with volunteers from this program to move to a San Francisco safe house commune called the Peking House. After that, he moves to another safe house in Concord, California, to keep a lower profile. He meets a woman named Patricia Saltzik, and the two form a new group called the Symbionese Nation, and this refers to the symbiotic relationship between various left revolutionary factions like feminism, black liberation, anti-capitalism, and he sees this movement forming a united front, living in harmony, living in communes, and then also organizing a unified revolutionary insurrection against the United States.
Mm.
Very new left.
I have to pause. My disk space is almost full. Give me one sec.
All right. We're recording. So
we're back. Anders is feeling a little sick.
I'm good.
But thanks, Zin.
But this
should have had a Zin, not a Velo.
Okay, about to say. I thought I was going to blame. I was going to make a joke about Howard Zinn, but
it's an inferior brand of Zinn, which is now there's a big shortage because they stopped selling it.
Yeah, but thanks to the Supreme Court shooting down the Chevron defense, we're going to get Zins and Juuls and everything. It's coming right back. They'll never take menthols away from us. Never take shit away from us again. Thank you, John Roberts.
Cool if true. All right.
Down with the administrative state. Let's go.
So, yeah, sorry about the interruption, everyone. Let's get back to the history of the SLA. So,
yes.
Donald DeFries and Patricia Saltzik have this concept of the Symbionese Nation, and their symbol of it is a hydra-headed cobra. So all of the necks and heads of the cobra are these different new left movements, and they come together with a unified body to attack the United States. Donald DeFries changes his name to General Field Marshal Sin Q, named after the leader of the Amistad Rebellion, and the other people in his cadre take on similar cool names.
Greetings to the people and fellow comrade brothers and sisters. My name is Sin Q, and to my comrades I am known as Sin. I am a black man and a representative of black people. I hold the rank of General Field Marshal in the United Federated Forces of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Today I have received an order from the Symbionese War Council, the Court of the People, to the effect that I am ordered to convey the following message in behalf of the SLA and to insert a tape word of comfort and verification that Patricia Campbell Hearst is alive and safe. The Symbionese Liberation Army is the federated union of military political elements of many different liberation struggles and of many different races. Our unified purpose is to liberate the oppressed peoples of this nation and to aid other oppressed people around the world in their struggle against fascist imperialism and the robbery of their freedom and homeland. Since this is the purpose and goal of the SLA, it is therefore clear to us, as it will be to all oppressed people, that our interest is to serve and defend the people and not ourselves, since the people shall always come first in our hearts and souls.
And in November, they carry out their first action by killing the superintendent of Oakland schools, Marcus Foster.
What the shit? Are you serious? They're knocking off school superintendents?
Yeah, I never got why they started with this guy or what this guy did that was so bad that they wanted to take him out, like of all the people in the world.
Well, what he did was he was the first black man to hold a position of superintendent of Oakland schools. He wanted students to have ID cards. And the SLA decided that this was a fascist measure.
That's an executable offense.
and they believe that killing him would get them the support of the black community in Oakland. But mostly, mostly people were appalled by this.
Mostly black people in Oakland are like, oh, well, that happened. I got to go to work now.
Yeah,
you know, we got jobs. We're not going to fall in with this killing school teacher shit.
Yeah, you could tell like how much of their own world they're living in when they think that like they elevated this black man to a leadership position. Obviously, we're against this sort of integration of the black community into the state that's going on in the 70s. So killing him is the appropriate measure. And generally speaking, even people who might have agreed with this criticism did not think that was the way to go.
Yeah, we are devolving deep, deep, deep into fucked up new left territory now. Go on, go on.
So they're further isolated. I mean, they're already like, you know, living in secret largely, but this tactic has made them even less popular. So they want to do something big for their next action, something that'll be... like,
we got to really kill someone even more offensive to people.
Well, in this case, they did not kill someone. In the winter of 1974, they kidnapped Patty Hearst, who was a student at Berkeley at the time. So they knew where she lived. They go to her house. They kidnapped her. And their plan is to use her as a hostage to negotiate the release of their comrades who were arrested in the assassination of Foster, the superintendent. Patty Hearst was the daughter of Randolph Hearst and the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, so the heiress of the Hearst publishing empire, which at one point it was sort of like a populist, even like or semi leftist publisher, but then it became very pro-fascist in the 30s and 40s. I'm not really sure what it was like at this point. Maybe more of just an innocuous press, I'm not sure. But it wasn't, I didn't get the impression that they kidnapped her for anything specific about the Hearst Corporation. She was just an easy target, and one where they thought they could win the release of their comrades. And then, in addition, they called for the government to fund a food program to distribute. At first, they asked for $4 million of food distributed to poor people, and then they ratcheted that up to $400 million shortly afterwards.
All right, so we've already devolved from the Panthers like 7-8 years previous to being like, we're going to self-organize like militant community food programs and shit like that, to now like trying to ransom the government to do it for them.
I mean, this is the critique of mutual aid, right? That you're just using your own resources and you have to seize power. Organize for it to be redistributed, and the only way to do that is by kidnapping and assassinations.
Well, I think it was more of a sort of public relations thing.
I see.
We're gonna show that people are poor and people need food, and win some sympathy that way. And they actually do. I mean, obviously, I think most people were horrified by this action. You know, it comes during a wave of bombings from the Weathermen and others, and they thought the Weathermen were too soft, right? So they're trying to present themselves as like the real Revolutionary Army, and of course they claim that they're much larger than they are. They claim that there's cells everywhere, that there's this whole army that's waiting to pounce, but in reality they're a small group living in a safe house, maybe two safe houses top, and they take Patty Hearst to one of these safe houses. There's actually a movie by Paul Schrader about this that's based on Patty Hearst's account of what happened, which is now on Criterion.
Oh, cool.
I recommend watching it. Ving Rhames plays Sin Q and does an amazing job.
Maybe they were trying to start an army of Patties, because they already had another Patricia, right?
They all have movement names. And so really quick about the food program, Hearst and Nixon, or I guess at this point it would be Ford, they
75.
Yeah, they do work out a food program, and at first it's in a way it proves their point, because when they're trying to distribute this food, there's like food riots trying to get it, which is kind of surprising. Like people were pointing to like a real issue of like people needed groceries, they couldn't afford it, and so they, after the sort of debacle of the first attempted food distribution planned by Hearst and the government, to free Patricia Hearst. They demanded it go to this other NGO to handle it in a more effective way. And they do put a lot of money into this other NGO, and I think maybe the food distributions continued it in a more orderly way. But so they kind of get a win from this. But while this is happening, Patty Hearst is being kept in a closet or a small room. She's being, you know, isolated, blindfolded, tortured in various ways, you know, and also indoctrinated. Mm. You know, they're like talking at her about their politics and about how like they're part of this revolutionary army that's about to overthrow the U.S. government. And as they bring her more into the life of the commune, like eventually they let her take off the blindfold and talk with them a little bit more. And she gives some, by her account, she's offered to be released for free. When negotiations are breaking down, they say, you can go, we won't do anything to you, or you can stay here and join our cadre and become a revolutionary. And she chooses to join the movement, to join the SLA. In her account, it's because she believes that if she had asked for her release, they would kill her.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, form of...
Maybe not wrong.
Greetings to the people. This is Tanya. On April 15th, my comrades and I expropriated $10,660.02 from the Sunset branch of the Hibernia Bank. Casualties could have been avoided had the persons involved cooperated with the people's forces and kept out of the way until after our departure. I was positioned so that I could hold customers and bank personnel who were on the floor. My gun was loaded, and at no time did any of my comrades intentionally point their guns at me. Careful examination of the photographs, which were published, clearly shows this is true. Our action of April 15th forced the corporate state to help finance the revolution. As for my ex-fiancé, I don't care if I ever see him again. During the last few months, Stephen has shown himself to be a sexist, ageist pig. Not that this was a sudden change from the way he always was. For those people who still believe that I'm brainwashed or dead, I see no reason to further defend my position. Consciousness is terrifying to the ruling class, and they will do anything to discredit people who have realized that the only alternative to freedom is death, and that the only way we can free ourselves of this fascist dictatorship is by fighting, not with words, but with guns. I am a soldier in the people's army. Patria o muerte, venceremos.
They did say, I mean, previously they were like, we're going to kill her if you don't do this stuff.
So that's right, okay.
Makes sense that...
And it wasn't out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
She endures some pretty messed up stuff, right? Trigger warning. There's, I believe, some essay.
Right. So part of this was part of her being like integrated into the life of this SLA cadre was free love. You know, the members were sleeping with one another as like comradely duty to some extent, and she was expected to take part in this, and she did. In her account, she was raped by the SLA and as a form of brainwashing.
Just all around odious stuff, man. Like, I think already by the time with all the boomers, like by the time I came around in the 90s with all of the hagiography of like the new left movement or whatever, there was none for this group, and for good reason. It also represents kind of like the logical endpoint of this weird, like kind of voluntaristic ultra leftist, like Maoish bullshit that they were spouting off.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Weathermen had, in my opinion, they were fairly stupid, but they had like a background in the movement that was pretty deep, and like they had some conception of this international armed struggle movement, including the Red Brigades and RAF and, you know, the Japanese Red Army. This group was a little bit more lumpen than that.
Right.
And they weren't killing.
So it was like a lumpen interpretation of an already middle class politics.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, of course, the Black Panthers did have this militant facade, and they were, you know, fighting cops, killing cops and that sort of thing. But it was much more intellectual and organized, and had a firm political basis rooted in like real communities and real projects.
Yeah, working class communities and projects. Yeah, for sure.
And this one was just like, through propaganda of the deed, basically, people will come to us and people will follow our example.
Yeah, the weather Rodniks in America.
The Weather Underground, at least, they were not killing civilians, right, or anybody.
Yeah, Weather Underground tried pretty hard not to kill anyone, to make sure they would bomb buildings when no one was there. And I think the only people they ever killed was themselves. Like,
Yeah. They blew up a brownstone in Greenwich Village, if I recall correctly.
That's what they call revolutionary suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There are martyrs.
You know, there's still people who are like, the SLA is based. We support them.
A lot of people on Twitter today would support something like the SLA. You better believe it.
Oh, sure. You can find people on Twitter to support anything. But for sure, like, when the movement's breaking down, you get people who are like, well, the movement's breaking down because we're not going hard enough, you know, we're not
right. Yeah.
You know, Mao led like went into the mountains and rounded up a people's army to surround the cities, and we have to do something like that. So,
but the SLA,
right, almost
they're they would speak in what was called at the time Jive, and I don't know if that would age well today. They really wanted to be black.
Well, another aspect of what they did was I think Sin Q was the only black leader of the group. In the Schrader movie, they show them making connections with Nation of Islam, and I'm not sure if that's true, but it was definitely
more middle class politics. Yeah.
It was a limited connection, if that. But despite the sort of connections that they had with people like Jack Scott, which we'll get to, they were mostly white, and their white members would move around in blackface. Believing, I guess, it would be less strange to see white people with a black man if everybody in the car was black. But yeah, if they were going from safe house to safe house, they would wear blackface. And by Hearst and Schrader's description, some of the white members did try to talk and act in a black manner.
It was bad enough when Ted Danson did it, man. Like, you guys are pinning a lot of shit on black people. You guys are, like, imposing and projecting a lot of shit on black people. And then they're, like, in blackface and hiding, man. Get the fuck out of here.
Is that really going to avoid attracting attention to have a bunch of people driving around in blackface? It must have been pretty good, at least.
Well, they never got pulled over.
Right.
But I'll get to, like, how it all comes crashing down. So in the spring of 1974, the group realizes that despite their limited support, they are largely alienated from the radical base in the Bay Area, and they decide to move to Los Angeles. And very quickly after moving to Los Angeles, they get involved into an armed confrontation at a sporting goods store.
Anti-sports.
Patty Hearst is in a van, and the other two members go into the store. One of them gets caught shoplifting from the store, and they shoot the security guard.
Oh my God!
I think Patty Hearst actually maybe she fired a warning shot at the security guard who tried to
handcuff. That's the SLA's relationship to the working class is if they get in their way, they get shot.
After this confrontation, they abandon the van, and the police find it, and they find the registration for their new safe house. And so they raid the safe house, and Sin Q and most of the core of the SLA are killed in the firefight that ensues. And it's one of the first major incidents that it's like broadcast live on TV.
Five suspected members of the Symbionese Liberation Army are dead following the bloodiest and most massive gun battle in the history of Los Angeles. Hundreds of police and FBI agents surrounded this small house on East 54th Street in the south central area of the city. Shortly before 6 p.m., gunfire erupted. For more than an hour, thousands of rounds of automatic weapons and small gunfire were exchanged between police and the suspects inside the house. Six tear gas assaults were made in an attempt to flush out the fugitives, until finally, houses on either side, as well as the pink wood and stucco fortress, caught fire. A fire believed to have been started by an exploding gas canister. It was an incredible, almost unbelievable ending to the most intensive manhunt of recent years. And yet, It was viewed as it happened by millions watching on national television. This is Pete Miller in Los Angeles.
Patty Hearst is with Emily and William Harris, and they escape this raid, and they go into hiding. And this is where Jack Scott comes into the story.
Uh-huh.
Jack Scott, through his connections, is able to contact the Harris couple and Patty Hearst and helps transport them to a refuge at a farmhouse in Pennsylvania. So in Scott's versions of the story, he actually recruited his father to help bring them to Pennsylvania. And in the backseat is Tanya, who is Patty Hearst. That's her movement name. And at one point, Jack Scott's father and Patty Hearst are alone in the car, and he says, you know, I can get you out of here. I can take you somewhere else. And he claims her answer was, take me where the fuck you're supposed to or you'll be dead, not just Jeez. Me.
Damn, dude. Oh.
She later denied that this ever happened. But
that sounds to me like Stockholm Syndrome, right? But I don't know enough about the story.
So Scott's assisting them under the pretenses of writing a book about them or helping them write a book. But they say he wasn't a good writer. He had a connection with some ghostwriters and publishers, and their relationship sort of broke down. And so the whole Pennsylvania thing doesn't really work out either for Scott's book or for the SLA. And the group returns to the Bay Area in 1975 to, commit more armed robberies. I forgot to even mention, you know, this important moment where Hearst is involved in a bank robbery and reads a statement, and somebody shot in the process. Someone shot and killed.
That image becomes completely like abstracted away and becomes like a call for arms for all sorts of like subversive types for the next 40 years, despite this entire incident being so stupid and her being abused by these people. Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're doing more crimes out in California in 1975, and eventually they all get arrested. And Scott and his associates are questioned for their involvement, but somewhat mysteriously, Scott was never charged. And he actually defended his involvement with them, saying that he saved lives because if they had stayed in California, the police raid would have involved police officers getting killed in an inevitable gunfight. So he actually, you know, he says that he was actually doing the right thing here.
Right. Doing the right thing. A little self-serving, but there you go.
Yeah, I wonder why he wasn't charged. I mean, he says in the Bill Walton book that because this is in the mid-70s, Ford comes into office in 74, not 75. But when Carter becomes president, that's kind of a theme, is like, we're going to move past these 60s, 70s, you know, early 70s, like spats and this crazy time. And he kind of is more willing to pardon people who are involved in this type of activity. So I think that's probably why Scott didn't ultimately get charged, but he was like investigated by the FBI for a long time, and people around him were questioned. His parents were harassed.
He meets with William Randolph Hearst at one point, and I'm not sure how that went.
Yeah, this was in the Bill Walton book too.
Okay, yeah. Why don't you get to the Bill Walton part of this now?
Okay, yeah. So Bill Walton, for those who don't know, the basketball player, died recently, was a hippie basketball player, and originally from San Diego. His parents were actually met at a tall person's club in, I guess, the 30s and 40s. Neither of them gave a lick about sports, but he was really tall, and growing up just loved basketball. His parents were both like fairly intellectual. But growing up in San Diego, it was at the time a fairly liberal place, and he goes to UCLA for college during the Vietnam War, and is a really interesting guy. He has a speech impediment. He can't really talk. He has like a stutter,
Like our president.
Yes.
We saw that the other night during the debate.
Right. Similar. Yeah.
They're not, like 4 years ago, they were like, oh, Biden has a stutter.
Right.
He's come out as a stuttering American, and we have to respect that. I think it was clearly bullshit then, but it worked. Now no one's saying it. Now no one's blaming us on stutter. Right.
Yeah. Well, unlike Biden, Bill Walton's stutter didn't come back. Maybe if he had lived another 10 years, it would have, but he was able to overcome that, and was a very political guy, and was arrested when he was at UCLA for protesting the Vietnam War, was a high-valued draft pick, and is drafted by the Portland Trailblazers, which is kind of the perfect team for him, and it's interesting. He's moving up the West Coast, goes from San Diego, UCLA, then to Portland, Oregon, and is a radical. I mean, it's in his later years, there's this documentary about him, ESPN did, called The Luckiest Guy in the World, where he is asked about kind of his radical past, and he's like, I'm in the mainstream. I am in the mainstream. And in his later years, like, he's not as outspoken about like far left issues. He, you know, hates conservatives, and there's a great clip where he's like, because he was a commentator in his later years, and there's a great clip where he's broadcasting a Liberty University game, and he's like, that name is such an oxymoron, Liberty University, because that goes everything goes against everything that school's about. But this kind of overshadowed his past in the 70s, where he became friends with Jack Scott and Jack's wife Mickey, and let them live with him in Portland, and let Jack write this book, Bill Walton. It was, you know, as a associate, Bill Walton on the road with the Portland Trailblazers, and this is, you know, when they're starting to get good.
Your political beliefs, I guess, are known by everyone in the world. I guess you've said it all once or twice. Your thoughts now that Patty Hearst has been taken back. Forgive me for asking you this as a sports reporter, but I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't. What is your thinking now about Patty Hearst?
I don't know too much about it, you know. The Oregon papers don't cover it very much, and Oregon papers don't cover too much of anything very much. But I don't want to comment on it because I don't know too much about it.
Did you ever meet her? Do you know her?
I wouldn't know her if she walked up to me on the street.
What about your friends, the Scots? What's their situation now? Are they happy? Are they unhappy? Or do they have any thoughts on the situation?
I'm sure they have some thoughts. We haven't discussed it too much lately. They're doing just fine. And, we're really enjoying Oregon right now. Oregon's a nice place to live. I just wish we had more sunny days like here.
He was also plagued with injuries, and a lot of people blamed that on him being a vegetarian at the time. Like, he's not getting enough protein. That's why he's getting hurt. But because the FBI is like poking around everything involving SLA, everyone adjacent to them, they're harassing Jack Scott and his family. His parents are like, they manage, Jack Scott's parents manage a apartment complex in Las Vegas for a while, and they're like struggling to make ends meet. But Bill Walton is questioned by the FBI, and he just gives them an interview, but then later regrets that. And this is while he's a player with the Trailblazers, goes down to a church in San Francisco and gives a press conference alongside Jack Scott and Mickey and a radical preacher at the time. And he says that Americans should take on the practice of non-cooperation with the existing government because of the inherent evil of that government. He's talking about the Vietnam War and other things, but the assumption behind the FBI is that all radicals just knew each other. And he's asked about like stuff that he's done, Bill Walton has done, irrespective of Jack Scott, because he's made quote unquote anti-American statements about the United Fruit Company, which he says he will, he refuses to invest in. He says
that's a proud American company right there.
He says, I don't believe in capitalism. I believe wealth should be spread around. And he also says, and this was raised a lot of eyebrows, I guess, with the FBI, that he said he was overpaid. He's got a contract that was worth more than $2 million, which at the time is a lot. And
you know, that's something that Jack Scott's type of, like the, that might be like something that would have flown in 1970, but like sort of the story of is moving towards strengthening the unions for the major leagues and like major professional leagues. And of course in baseball, I'm not sure how exactly how this played out in the other sports, but the big goal was getting free agency. Because it used to be if you were an athlete, you were just under contract for one team for your entire career, and then they could give you a raise, but there was the top paid players never really made as much as they could until Kurt Flood, who was also sort of connected to black radicalism and black liberation, a player for the Cardinals, challenged the reserve clause. And he lost that case, but through losing the case, Marvin Miller at the Baseball Players Union was able to figure out how to, through arbitration, and it's too complicated to get into here, but how to win free agency for players. And immediately the top players start getting contracts approaching $1 million. And by the end of the 70s, Nolan Ryan, I think, gets the first $1 million per season contract. Reggie Jackson gets a really huge contract, too. And this was... this was like the goal of the MLBPA, was to make sure top stars were being paid. And of course that meant journeyman players and lower, everybody above the minor leagues was getting paid much, much better. And so the kind of militancy that led to the strength of the players union, inspired by black radicalism, the social aspects of it really go away, and it becomes strengthening the union so payers get paid. So it's interesting that Walton had this statement of like, I'm overpaid, because that's almost like an anti-solidaristic statement.
Right, because, you know, that's as a radical, you look at that and like, oh, that's too much money, you shouldn't have it. But if you're a Marxist, you're looking at all the money he generates for the team, and he should be making that money. But he has a passage in the book, on the Portland, on Jack Scott's book, they let Bill Walton write a little bit, and he says the struggle of athletes to gain their rights is not new; goes back years and years. Many athletes have given up their struggle because of the repressive conditions set by leagues, owners, and the media. We as workers must not forget the position we are in. It is our skills that create goods and services, and we must not allow outsiders to prevent us from doing the things we like to do and do so well. There's also a scene in the book where he's overheard by a ref in the NBA, because they have a union, they're considering going on strike, the refs, and they overhear Bill Walton saying, I don't think anyone should cross a picket line. And, you know, he's an influential player, so they take that as a sign that maybe they should go ahead with a strike, but then he winds up saying, like, I got to stick with my union, and whatever they say, like, I'm gonna, whatever we decide collectively, I'm gonna go along with. But on the Hearst point, so Jack Scott did meet with Randolph Hearst, who goes by Randy apparently, like someone else I know, but Hearst basically doesn't want to come out with this the things that he's telling to Jack Scott. So Jack Scott kind of either, maybe it's possible he's making this up, he's like fictionalizing a little bit, but I don't think he is. I think this is actually stuff Randolph Hearst said, that he was upset with the FBI. And if he opens the meeting by saying, like, well, first of all, why didn't you guys kidnap me? Which would make more sense, right?
Because he didn't live in Berkeley.
Yeah, that's true. but also like he's mad at the FBI because they almost killed his daughter.
Yep.
Because of that shootout.
And the SLA, I think they said it beforehand. Like if you come for us, you're going to kill Patty Hearst. Mm-hmm. And they probably, if she was at that safe house, they probably would have.
Yeah. Yeah. So he, there's like, you know, obviously Randolph Hearst is not radicalized, but there's, you know, he definitely sees things in a new light after having to deal with the FBI and realizing how little they actually value the life of his daughter.
So just to be clear, did Bill Walton knew Jack Scott but didn't have any connection with the actual SLA stuff?
Yeah, he never, at no point did he know the whereabouts of Patty Hearst.
That's for the best.
Yeah.
when the Neo SLA comes, I don't want to know anything about what they're doing.
Yeah.
If you out there, listener, are going to form like a Neo SLA cadre, leave us out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Despite our name.
Yeah, no, the name. We're
very critical of this conception of armed struggle.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's like Andy told the story earlier of like the degeneration of the new left, really. There was like maybe in the early to mid 60s, like a chance to have like a new American socialist movement. But within 10, 15 years, that's absolutely crushed due to, I don't know, a lot of different factors. But one of them certainly is people kind of trying to import Marxist, Leninist and Maoist ideas and nationalism and all sorts of things and impose them onto an American environment. Not going to work, folks. Didn't work.
I mean, the SLA, I think their conception of like a new left insurrection was interesting, but obviously it came late. And even if it didn't, the sort of the premise of the armed struggle, at least in the United States, was that like through these spectacular acts of violence, it would like push people to like rise up, you know? And like also seeing the repression of it. Would enrage people, but it was simply the opposite. People were horrified. Even the Vietnamese were horrified. There was like, I think in 72, there was this attempt to like surround the White House and force Nixon to call the Viet Cong leadership and work out an armistice. Like, you know, 'cause the Viet Cong had these demands and they were in like some loose connection with the movement. But when they saw the movement sort of degenerating, becoming less popular in the early 70s, they actually like called for the movement to stop.
Please stop trying to help.
It was making them look bad.
Right, yeah. Oh, shit.
Maybe we can move on now to the afterlife of the survivors. Patty Hearst is, of course, charged with murder and robbery and, you know, everything she took part in, and she maintained her innocence because she said, like, they were, you know, I was kidnapped. They were forcing me to do these things. They were sexually abusing me and such. And so she was convicted, but I think she was had her sentence commuted by Carter pretty shortly after she was convicted. Maybe she did a year or two. And then Bill Clinton eventually pardoned her.
Mm.
And she became an actress and starred in a couple John Waters movies.
By the time the 90s comes, like, Bill Clinton and company are like, look, we're on to a new thing now. It's neoliberalism. A lot of the same principle you guys were working with, right? But we're going to do it right, and we're going to do it capitalistically. So let's let bygones be bygones. Let Patty Hearst live her life, man. Yeah. She can be part of the new American century and all that good stuff.
Right. But also, you know, her account is like heavily debated about whether she did or did actually believe in what she was doing or not. But I just think, like, under the conditions that she was kidnapped and treated, you just can't find she should not have been convicted for that. It's ridiculous.
No, it is absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's like, why did Bukharin admit his guilt, you know, when he wasn't guilty during the show trials? Because he was horribly tortured.
Right.
So anyway.
That'll piss a couple people off.
Yeah, probably. Good.
But it's the truth.
Let it. It's the truth.
Yeah, you know, this point that you made about like neoliberalism sort of supplanting the new left, and in a way it's true, because I think the Democratic Party in the 70s, and Carter was the best example of this, really did become this sort of movement of movements, but more drawing from the kind of NGO basis that was set up by the New Left, like groups like Acorn, for example. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned a few of the pieces earlier in the story, the pieces being like the call for representation, you know, black and brown representation in politics and whatever. And then also, of course, as you were saying, the NGOs as well. I don't want to smear the entire New Left because I think that there were like good people doing good work. I think the industrializers were largely right. They just didn't realize that like deindustrialization would be a thing. Sojourner Truth and people like that, the TDU people did excellent work. But like what the story you described was like the middle class, like adventurous side of things. Yeah. And that I think in retrospect, there was no potential for it, but there was also a potential for it to be recuperated relatively easy, large swaths of it, as we saw by the time the 90s come.
And so finally, Jack Scott, after this, after, you know, linking up with the SLA and being questioned by the FBI and avoiding any charges, he drifts away from politics and becomes a successful physiotherapist.
Good for him. He did something productive.
He was specialized in treating runners with a technique of electrical stimulation to heal injuries. He worked with Carl Lewis, Jackie Joyner Kersee.
Cool.
And he became rich doing this. And so he lived the rest of his life putting everything behind him. I think most of the people he worked with probably had no idea about his past. And when it was brought up, he would say, like, let a sleeping dog lie. I don't give a damn about any of it. It was a crazy time, you know. So sort of normal boomer attitude towards the 60s of like, yeah, right. It was crazy. You know, let's not talk too much about what happened.
Yeah. And they say there's no second acts in American life. He went on to become rich and successful.
Yep.
Typical boomer.
Yeah. I mean, this is really indicative of thousands, if not millions, of people who had these beliefs and acted on them in many cases and then were able to still just call it quits on the politics and get rich. You know?
Well, you know, the thing that damned him from the very beginning was his utopian conception, like similar to utopian conceptions we have nowadays around language or police or incarceration or whatever, that you can find these little like secondary epiphenomenal aspects of hierarchy and capitalism. And if you can change those and like in court, like pull them in a certain direction, that you can change society. And as we saw with all utopian attempts of that period, including communes and cadres or whatever, turns out those relations of production, man, they're fucking sticky.
Yeah.
Really sticky.
Yeah, this is something that we get into a lot in the Arm Love series about the sort of abandonment of the movement for communes. And the communes could be safe houses, could be places where people could like stockpile arms or whatever, but the insurrection simply wasn't coming. And of course, for an insurrection to work, you need a lot more than just leftists and like dropout culture people. You need the working class large, and the working class rejected these politics.
And also,
absolutely,
something I found interesting is Harry Edwards wrote Revolt of the Black Athlete, still around today. He's actually in a movie on Netflix about the NBA, and how the story of it is essentially that an agent has to stop his players from bypassing the NBA and just making more money doing like one-on-one games, and like he kind of keeps everything together, spoiler alert, and Harry Edwards has a cameo in that. But he at the time was saying like, because he was a contemporary of Jack Scott, but didn't buy into a lot of the, you know, the communism aspect of it. And he was like, I have enough trouble being black. I don't have the wherewithal to be red also. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, you know, he's more focused on other things. And to this day, we'll say that advances that have been made with race in athletics have been transactional, and he views that as like a fine thing, and also has always been opposed to kind of this, I guess, teleology that one day there's going to be this final battle and we're going to overthrow capitalism and create a new society. Because as he points out, all the same civil rights that people were fighting for in the 60s were still fighting. They get taken away and you just have to keep fighting and trying to get them back. And there's just, there's no final struggle. It's just perpetual.
Well, I would say, you know, I think history has borne that out, but it's interesting to look back at, for example, Paul Robeson, who was one of the first integrators of football, and Jackie Robinson, who was the first black man to play in the major leagues in 1947. The concept of Robinson being elevated to the major leagues was deeply political. The attempt to break the color line was fought by this coalition. Before Branch Rickey, there was this coalition of sports writers and activists sort of took the struggle to integrate unions and, you know, the government workforce before the war, took it to Major League Baseball. And part of that movement were communists. You know, Paul Robeson was a communist sympathizer. And there was, you know, a sports section in the Daily Worker, the communist paper, that was pushing these things too. But Branch Rickey and the other baseball owners who integrated were very careful to separate this movement. And in fact, the first, you know, Jackie Robinson was always a very political person, even before he became a professional athlete. But the first political thing he did after becoming a professional athlete was testify against Paul Robeson in 1949. Robeson had made a statement saying that black Americans would not fight the Soviet Union in a war. And he went to the HUAC hearing and said, this is not true. We can't have black people associated with communism. And Robinson actually became a Republican for a time. He abandoned those politics later in his life. But the concept of his integration was really a sort of liberal Republican concept that if we could demonstrate that black people can play on playing field with white people, then they would be welcomed into the middle class. And then and gradually, as more black people get better jobs, racism will simply fade away. This anti-black prejudice and fear will go away. And to an extent, this was true. I mean, Robinson and other and Willie Mays and other black athletes breaking these
rest in peace.
Yeah. Yeah. R.I.P.
Breaking the color barrier was definitely a major leap forward. It foreshadowed the civil rights movement that came really started 10 years after. And black athletes became a part of the civil rights movement. But the fear of the owners was that it would that black baseball players would challenge the highly exploitative system of sports contracts, and they did. And so there could have been a strong baseball union if it stayed white, but the integration of black workers into baseball about 20 years after Robinson leads to this strong unionization.
Interesting. Very interesting.
But then the unionization leads to the, you know, the fracturing of the social aspects of that. And so, especially in baseball, but in others, but I, you know, basketball stayed, I think, a fairly political sport where athletes could express themselves openly, and it became a very black game of largely black stars and their personalities and their political thoughts that never really happened in baseball, unfortunately.
Well, it's interesting that there's a chapter in The Athletic Revolution, which I don't know if it's written by Jack Scott, because it's kind of, you know, he has other people write some of the chapters, but about social mobility and how sports is kind of this thing that's sold to black Americans in many cases as like, this is how you can get ahead and enter not just the middle class, but be wealthy and then create generational wealth is through sports. And it's a raw deal for most people who try to do it, because you ruin, especially in a sport like football, you ruin your body and your mind in a lot of cases in pursuit of this thing that only a very small portion of people achieve.
I mean, this is just the fundamental lie of the middle class perspective of American life, is that everyone can be in it.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, even if we didn't have, even if anti-black racism and the heavy exploitation of black and non-white workers faded away, there would just still need to be a lower middle class, a subclass, you know, that you can't just
expand the middle class until the point that everyone's equal.
Absolutely. And that, of course, has been getting worse because America's founded as a property owner's republic. And as we know from our Marx, like, property is always in the process of abolishing itself, even like private and personal property. You see, this is why everyone freaks out when Blackstone or Bill Gates starts buying up a bunch of property, because it's part of like a self-driven process towards the abolition of property. What do you do when your entire political system is based upon, you know, petty property? Well, things get all shitty real quick.
Maybe we can close out talking a little about sports today. And, like, you know, if Jack Scott were still a radical, you know, he passed away in, I think, 2000. But yeah. if we can channel the spirit of 1970 Jack Scott, you know, what would he be excited about today? How would he think sports could be different or better? Mm. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is in 2020, after Kenosha, when Major League Sports are being played in these sort of contained bubbles, there was a general strike that began during the playoffs. The Timberwolves refused to play because of the shooting in Kenosha.
Bucks.
Oh, the Bucks, right. And then that spread throughout basketball and to other sports, including baseball. The very proud of the Mets and the Marlins walking off the field against the wishes of the owner and the commissioner after the shooting of Jacob Blake and the murder of three protesters during the riots that followed. And so there was this sports-wide general strike, and LeBron James was the figurehead of it. And I think it easily could have deepened and spread outside of sports. But what happened?
Barack Hussein Obama. Thanks, Obama.
He calls LeBron and he says, go back to work, but we're going to turn stadiums into places where people can register to vote.
Yes, the perfect Obama thing.
God.
And James agreed, and sports went back to normal, although they would write fight racism on the field or put BLM on the mound or on uniforms. So
I feel like if Jake Scott was around, you know, if he had like somehow just managed to be like an assistant coach and he was there, he might have had a positive influence on LeBron. You know, LeBron, it's one of the problems with like being isolated politically and politics just being like one person's opinion and like feeling strongly about something. No, LeBron didn't have the support. Mm. Jack Scott could have given him support. Bill Walton could have given him support. But yeah, he was off doing sports therapy and whatever, or dead. Yeah. I don't know the time frame.
Yeah, he was dead. He had been dead 20 years by that point.
And he was off being dead. He couldn't help anymore. But yeah. And Bill Walton, Scott's spirit had lived.
I am annoyed at Bill Walton for just giving up and just completely forgetting all of the. I mean, I'm sure he was supportive of the protests and the players at that time, but yeah, not taking an active role in inspiring them to take things into their own hands and stop playing. But with Jack Scott, you know, by the time he died, there wasn't a lot of this stuff going on, really. I'm trying to think, like, throughout the 90s, how much that was. I know there was a Muslim basketball player, and I think the early 90s, who decided to fast during a game, and that was kind of like a flashpoint in sports. But going into if he had lived like a few decades longer, you know, you have Pat Tillman, who at first seems like a very nationalistic figure, and then we now know more about this in retrospect, but was the, you know, corresponding with Noam Chomsky. Mm-hmm. And
he was a football player who was killed in Afghanistan
by friendly fire,
and he was against the war, which is an interesting story.
Yeah. Or he had, I think he had plans to meet with Chomsky after he got back. So maybe that would have put some fire in Jack Scott's belly. And I definitely think Colin Kaepernick, people may have sought a quote or two from Jack Scott, and that mm-hmm. would have animated him.
Yeah, I think maybe the lesson we can learn from this, closing it out, is like, sure, sports seems like this big nationalistic propagandist bread and circus thing, but it's a very important spectacle to the mindset of Americans. Like, people love sports. Yeah.
They are very interested in what's going on behind the scenes. And when these movements come along, whether it be the anti-war movement against Vietnam, Black Lives Matter, or the George Floyd uprising, athletes can get activated and can take political action. And I think, you know, I don't think they will do it on their own, but if they can merge, if there's a large enough movement outside of sports, sports will merge with it and play an important role. Someone like Jack Scott, I think, understood this and thought that the role it could play is not simply getting out the vote for the Democrats, but pushing forward towards deeper confrontation with imperialism.
And I would say that, like, socialists and communists, certainly in the ILC, we believe in, like, having our own sports shit going on. So, like, joining a league or whatever. Like, not all sports takes place on this elite high level. There's, like, of course, like, camaraderie and friendship that happens in the process of this whole thing. And, you know, working class militants should get involved if they like sports. They shouldn't try to, like, do the equivalent of industrializing and, like, try to get really good at hockey.
Hello, fellow Giants fan.
Right,
did exactly. You see the big game last night?
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, it's June. There's no big game.
Exactly.
I could do this.
That's
pretty...
one way to out yourself as like an SLA sympathizer.
I could do the hockey thing pretty easily. I have the same name as a famous hockey player, so I can just sneak into the Barclays Center where they play. But I'm curious to actually, I mean, this gets a bit into the book you're working on, so, you know, no spoilers.
Sean, you can go if you need to, I understand.
Yeah, I'm gonna dip. I got this other call in just a little bit. All right, good talking with you guys. Yeah, Anders, take care, bro.
You too.
All right, see you, Sean.
Stay safe. Later.
But the spectator thing, you know, I know you have a different take on it from Scott, maybe that he's, you know, he's like, spectator sports is bad, sports in its purest form is just you playing it, but sports under communism, would there still be spectator sports?
So one model we can look at for this is Cuba. When Castro comes into power, baseball is huge in Cuba. There is a major team in Havana that's part of the International League, so there's a lot of minor league players who are, like, on their way to being in the majors who are playing in Cuba either for the team or against the team. And actually this team sticks around after the revolution for a season, and they actually play the minor league World Series in Havana, and people are, like, shooting off guns in the crowd.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, Castro gives a rousing speech beforehand. So, this was obviously very horrifying to the major league players and the owner of the team. This was in 1959 or maybe 1960. And so the team is, you know, brought to Jersey City out of Havana, and Castro reestablishes the Cuban Baseball League as a non-professional, purely amateur league. And baseball continues in Cuba, and Cuba continues producing amazing players. And in the 90s, you start seeing players defect from Cuba, like going to the Dominican Republic and then finding their way to the United States and signing major league contracts there. But also you see Cuban players kind of treated the same way that Cuban doctors are treated. They're, like, sent to play in other places as part of, like, a natural resource of Cuba. So even though Cuba has this sort of communistic sports league, it still has to compete on the world market and uses its players as a sort of way to defend Cuba or bring money to the country that it needs. And that's the most communistic sports league I know about. I guess the best thing that you could say about it with all certainty is it's produced incredible players, even lacking the first world coaching that the major leagues uses for its camps around the world. And of course, you have examples of, like, the Soviet Union having incredible Olympic athletes, which was kind of an uglier story than Cuba pumping them full of PEDs and hormones and stuff.
Ivan Drago?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, Ivan Drago is a good representation of it. I guess the point of it is that athletics doesn't go away. Not everyone doesn't just become soy under communism. All right, I think we're good. Thanks for listening, everyone. Let's go, Mets.
Let's go, Mets. Let's go,
like,
Vikings.
Vikings.
Yeah, Skol.
What's Skol?
Oh, you don't know this? This is, well, that's also a little tobacco pouch thing, right? Skol? Well, so that's the Vikings. The chant is their song. The fight song is Skål, Viking, Skål. Skål, Viking, Skål. And Skål in Norwegian means like toast. It's like cheers.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yep.
That's pretty People, cool.
I was at a bar for the playoff game last year, and this, and everyone was chanting, and this woman turns over, and she's like, why is everyone saying Skål?
Yeah.
Is this some satanic ritual thing, or like some really hardcore Viking, like you rip out people's skulls? That's part of the lore here. But no, it's just a little toast.
Okay, Skål to you, and Skål to all the listeners. Good night. Dog, and I will stay on the run, and they can speculate what I'm feeling, but Dad.